Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quickly checking Valley traffic. 101 eastbound, an accident at 32nd Street has the center lanes blocked. On the 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident blocks the 52nd Street on-ramp. And on the 10 westbound, the exit ramp at Estrella Parkway is restricted. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 91 degrees. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid to upper 60s. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 95. It's sunny and 86 degrees right now. Prosecutors will have another six-plus years to refile charges against Leslie Merritt Jr. in connection with the I-10 shootings. On Tuesday, a Maricopa County Superior Court judge denied a request by Merritt's attorneys to permanently dismiss the case. The defense said prosecutors sought to avoid a June trial when they moved to dismiss charges against Merritt last month. Prosecutors countered their decision was based on evidence and the defense was speculating. Ulysses Farragut is one of Merritt's lawyers.
Quite frankly, if this case ever went back to court, like I said, I have absolutely no doubt that a jury of his peers will find him not guilty unanimously.
Merritt's attorneys say he was not in the courtroom because he was working. The parties will head back to court on June 17th for a hearing on whether the state should release Merritt's car and gun. A bill that expands access to an opiate overdose reversal drug has made it to Governor Doug Ducey's desk. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the measure passed the House and Senate unanimously over the weekend.
Current Arizona law restricts the administration of the opiate overdose reversal drug known as Naloxone, or Narcan, to just medical technicians or police. The bill at the governor's office expands that to include anyone in a position to assist. It also gives someone who administers the medication or prescribes it immunity from liability if they've acted in good faith. Haley Coles is with Sonoran Prevention Works, a group involved in drafting the legislation.
What that means is that organizations like mine, Sober Living Homes, Homeless Outreach Project, can give out the medication as a prescription without the prescriber needing to be present.
Cole says if the governor signs the bill, it would allow nonprofits like hers to set up programs across the state to make the medication easily accessible. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Governor Doug Ducey continues to act on the pile of bills lawmakers sent him in the waning hours of their session. Today brought both new laws and new vetoes. Here to talk about that is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, first off, the governor signed the budget today, right?
Yes. I think that once everything was worked out, it wasn't exactly the budget he asked for. In fact, it's sort of fascinating that he crowed in his press release about a pro-education budget when, in fact, the budget that was negotiated and he and the speaker and the president sent down actually had less money for education than what was there. But that's fine. You know, everybody gets to lead a parade from time to time. This was a very carefully negotiated measure, and everybody got a little of what they wanted, and they decided that this is as good as it's going to get. Now, that doesn't mean the Democrats are happy, but then again, the Democrats are very rarely happy with the budget.
The governor also had a number of gun-related bills on his desk. He signed a couple of them and vetoed one?
Yes. The one he vetoed is the most far-reaching. It would have required Arizona to enter into interstate compacts with any other state, and it would say that we're deciding that we're all going to keep our gun laws as far as things like background checks the same as they are now. Therefore, we're going to agree not to amend our own laws. In fact, we're going to preempt amending our own laws. And the governor said, look, I'm a big believer in the Second Amendment. I've signed gun bills in the past. I signed a few more, in fact, today. But I'm not sure we should give up our own sovereignty to allow other states to determine what we can do.
How about the two gun bills he signed? What would they do?
One of them is a fairly minor change in the law. Current law does not allow guns on college and university campuses. But it was pointed out that on many of these campuses, you actually have public streets running adjacent to and through these streets, public sidewalks maintained by the public. And technically speaking, I suppose, if you drove through the ASU campus on a street that was maintained by Tempe and had a gun with you, you would be violating the law. this takes care of that. The other one is a little stricter. There's already laws in the books that say cities cannot enact gun laws that are stricter than the state allows. Well, Tucson has a couple of interesting ordinances, the more far-reaching of which says if your gun is stolen or you lost it, you're supposed to report it to police. And the contention is, well, they can't do that because that's a gun transfer law, and the cities can't do that. Well, the city attorney basically gave the state a two-word response, and the first word was not thank. And so Steve Smith came back with legislation to say, okay, if you enact these laws, we will allow anybody to take you to court and levy large fines and perhaps even have public officials removed from office. The governor did sign that measure.
Howie, as you obviously know, at the end of the legislative session late last week, a lot of bills going up to the governor. He still has a number on his desk. What are some of the bigger, more high-profile ones that he still has yet to act on?
Well, there's a few. One is the so-called Supreme Court packing bill, which would expand the Arizona Supreme Court to 7 members. The justices say it isn't necessary. The proponents say that they're trying to add some diversity to the court, which is sort of an interesting argument since when the governor had a choice to make and named Clint Bowlick, he named a white male. But be that as it may, there's an idea that somehow having 7 voices is better than having 5. He has the bill to relieve Corporation Commissioner Andy Tobin of his conflicts of interest because of where his son-in-law works for Solar City. There's some changes in some abortion laws, and there's one of these interesting local preemption bills that says cities cannot regulate online booking firms like Airbnb. The cities are very concerned that you're going to have a situation where somebody could buy up a whole series of homes in a neighborhood and simply rent them out, but not zone it for things like a hotel, and you'd have a de facto hotel in a residential neighborhood.
Howie Fisher, is Capital Media Services keeping an eye on all the bills still pending before the governor? Howie, thanks as always.
Well, I'll be watching for the next 200 to come down the pike.
The AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety reports in Washington State, fatal accidents involving drivers who'd recently used marijuana doubled after voters in that state legalized recreational marijuana use. And the group says that's relevant in Arizona since voters may decide a similar ballot measure this fall. Linda Gorman is the Director of Public Affairs and Communications at AAA Arizona.
While this doesn't necessarily point to a positive correlation between marijuana and crashes, it does provide an eye-opening, I think, look into what states might experience if they legalize marijuana. So we recognize that more research is needed, but it does provide perhaps an alarming look at what can happen after marijuana is legalized and after people use marijuana and get behind the wheel.
Arizona is obviously one of those states that could be deciding this question. There's a ballot measure that may be on the ballot in November. Mm-hmm. Is this report a position on the part of AAA, one way or the other, on that?
No, we don't take a position on marijuana use, nor do we take a position, you know, on alcohol use. However, what we do want to provide is some interesting dialogue and some additional dialogue on how, you know, legalizing this drug may have unintended consequences, so that if states are looking to legalize it, we need to make sure that our existing impairment laws are up to date, they include the most recent research, and that they are relevant and can help identify and target those drivers who are most impaired.
What kinds of updates or changes do you think the impairment driving laws need in Arizona?
Mm-hmm. Well, currently Arizona has a zero tolerance for many drugs, really illicit drugs, including marijuana, which means that it is illegal to drive a vehicle if you are impaired to the slightest degree. So that means that if you are found by a blood test to have any trace of THC, which is the impairment component in marijuana, you could be charged with impairment. Now, while that sounds at face value like that would be sufficient, unfortunately, recent research has shown that it is not an accurate correlation to look at THC amounts and judge by impairment. So if you think about it, there's a lot of research that is decades of research that have gone into alcohol and driving. We know, for example, that a person's blood alcohol level at 0.05, 0.08 demonstrate consistent impairment. We don't know that about marijuana. There hasn't been the same type of research, and we don't know how really it impairs people in terms of the amount correlating to the amount of THC in their system.
Has Arizona seen an increase in traffic accidents in the years since medical marijuana has become legal here?
Well, the interesting thing about, and that also points to another element that needs to be addressed if states look at legalizing marijuana, is that currently state crash records separate these types of crashes into alcohol and drugged driving. And so we don't right now have a way to accurately track marijuana impaired driving. And so we believe that states that, including Arizona, states that do consider legalizing marijuana, that the data collection is allowed to, or you're allowed to categorize and track marijuana impairment.
I hate to ask you to speculate about something that might be going on illegally, but I'm curious if you think that if marijuana becomes legal in Arizona, do you think that there will be appreciably more people using it here than there are right now?
Well, you know, when we looked at Washington State, and of course this is people self-reporting, but before the drug was legalized, they found that about 7.5% of the public admitted to using cannabis. After the drug was legalized for recreational use, that went up to about 10.5%. Now, to the extent that it increases, or the extent that people are more willing to admit it because the drug is now legal, you know, that's an important factor to consider too.
Linda Gorman is the Director of Public Affairs and Communications at AAA Arizona. The campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol has been collecting signatures to put this issue to Arizona voters in November. Barrett Marson is the group's spokesman.
You know, it's important to point out, the study points it out, as a matter of fact, that just because someone had THC in their system, that wasn't necessarily responsible for the crash. In addition, nearly half of the drivers who did test positive for marijuana also tested positive for alcohol, and about a quarter tested positive for drugs other than marijuana.
Marson doesn't dispute there's less research about the effects of THC than alcohol on drivers. He also points out a study in Colorado, where recreational pot use is also legal, shows fewer drivers were cited for a marijuana-related DUI last year than in prior years. But Marson says if Arizona voters legalize it here, lawmakers will have some work to do.
There is no doubt that Arizona should be up to date with its impairment laws. That is absolutely something we support. That is important to do.
Arizona is not the only state which could ask its voters to legalize recreational marijuana, and many adults across the country already have the ability to use pot freely. So how is this trend affecting young adults? KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joins me with more on that. And Jimmy, what have researchers seen? I mean, what are the trends among younger people as marijuana use increases?
It seems to be fairly level. The National Institute of Drug Abuse is kind of the go-to place for these kinds of numbers. And according to them, daily marijuana use among 12th graders, so seniors in high school, it's remained stable in recent years at around 6%. But a third of them had tried marijuana in the past year. So daily use is not that high, but it does seem like a lot of teenagers are smoking pot.
So I guess that's not really a huge surprise, though.
Maybe not, but for teens who use marijuana daily or even weekly, the consequences could be serious because our brains are still developing when we're in high school. Dustin Pardini is a professor at the ASU Criminology Department. He researches the effects of chronic drug use, and he's working on a study with a really interesting data set.
The unique thing about the study is that it's collected data annually on adolescents and collected information about how much marijuana they were using each year, their subclinical psychotic symptoms, like just feeling paranoid, feeling like they saw something that other people said weren't there, heard things that other people said they didn't hear.
So, Jimmy, you mean to tell me that people have been getting high and then talking to a researcher at a university somewhere?
Yes, in Pennsylvania, and they kept self-reporting every year into their 30s. So what Pardini looked at is how that chronic pot use affected them over time and if it led to an increase in psychotic disorders. You know, that these smaller warning signs might become larger problems.
What we found was this very systematic link between during the years that they smoked marijuana, we saw an increase in feelings of paranoia, feelings of that they were seeing things that other people said weren't there. And then that increased risk remained even when they stopped using for a year-long period of time, suggesting that there might be some lingering effects on these subclinical symptoms.
But Jimmy, we're still talking about teens and college students reporting paranoia and hallucinations. They're obviously dealing with a lot of emotions and hormones and maybe using other substances too, right?
That's possible, but Pardini says they attempted to account for all those factors.
We didn't see the same relationship for alcohol use. We didn't see the same relationship for tobacco use. We also looked at, is this something that's accounted for by just general fluctuations in emotional problems and other behavioral problems. So we controlled for those fluctuations. And that actually made the relationship between marijuana use and psychotic, subclinical psychotic symptoms stronger. So there's definitively, in our analysis, a clear specific link between this form of substance use, marijuana use, and these symptoms.
So it could be for most people that those feelings go away with age, but the kids that use pot chronically, even if they stopped, those feelings continued later on in life.
So those kids have a greater chance of developing a disorder?
Pardini says they're taking the approach that mental health disorders should be viewed on a continuum. It kind of depends on the person.
You go from having these mild symptoms, and then for some people that transitions into full-blown schizophrenia or a more severe disorder. And when you talk about the linkage between marijuana use and schizophrenia, it's probably mediated through the experience of these more mild perceptual disturbances, and then for a very small portion of the population that also transitions into this more severe manifestation.
So, Mark, if you're a parent talking to your kids about marijuana or you're a young adult using pot, it's important to look for those symptoms and be wary of those strong adverse effects. It could be your brain's way of saying that that particular substance just isn't for you.
That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thank you.
You're welcome, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ for Tuesday, May 10th. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Brody, along with The Takeaway's John Hockenberry today.
Are you trending? Have you ever been trending? Do you plan on trending anytime soon? Just heard that Steph Curry is trending after that outrageous return to the basketball court last night.
He fires up a three, does it again!
Well, of course Steph Curry is trending. But oxygen on Mars is also trending.
Get your ass to Mars.
And MIT wrinkle smoothing treatment is trending today.
Ooh.
Trump is trending, of course.
I have to say what I have to say.
Elizabeth Warren tweeting about Trump is also trending.
We're not going to go back to bartering pigs for haircuts.
We think of all these designations as the result of a statistical measurement of interest among online users. It's math, right? Highest number of emails, clicks, page views, wins. A report at the website Gizmodo, though, says that the team in charge of selecting what's trending on Facebook is responsible for systematically omitting conservative articles and content. Facebook says it follows rigorous guidelines to ensure consistency and neutrality, and that it works to be inclusive of all perspectives. Quote, "We take allegations of bias very seriously," a Facebook spokesman said in a statement. Facebook is a platform for people and perspectives from across the political spectrum. Where do trending stories come from? Well, it's a group of internal news curators who decides what order those stories will appear in. It's an arbitrary sounding process, but then why would we expect anything else? Jay Rosen is the author of Press Think, a blog about journalism in the digital age. He's a professor at New York University. Hello, Jay.
Hello, John.
Sean Davis is co-founder of The Federalist, a conservative online magazine. Hello, Sean.
Hi, John.
Are conservatives paranoid about what Facebook is doing to their content, or you notice something with some statistical bite behind it?
Well, I think we have seen, at least at The Federalist, we have personally experienced it. We have seen topics get driven down. We have had articles blocked or removed from being posted on Facebook. So what we saw from the admission of Facebook's own news curators confirmed what everyone in conservative publishing world already knew. Facebook's own news curators admitted, yes, we blacklist outlets and we push down trending topics that we don't like. So it's not paranoia when the people who've been doing it literally just admitted it.
Why is there an expectation that Facebook would do anything other than what it damn well pleases?
Well, in its own defense, they just said, oh, no, we have these rigorous guidelines to prevent bias, which is a non-denial denial. They never said they didn't do it. They only said they have rigorous processes in place. So why would I expect them to not be biased when they say they have processes in place to not be biased? It's kind of an odd question.
Why does trending come with the understanding that it's supposed to be unbiased, regardless of what Facebook says about its brand? I mean, we bring this assumption to trending. Facebook
doesn't necessarily bring it to trending.
Well, in a way it does, John, because all these platform companies want to be seen as technology companies and not as editorial engines. They don't describe themselves as a media company or as a news company. They want to take over the job of selecting news for users, but they don't want to be an editorial company, by which I mean they specifically don't want to be in the business of picking what stories are on the front page.
But they have a front page, and they're picking stories, so therefore they're a news organization.
This is the problem. They don't want to be an editorial company, but they are serving in that role. They haven't matured enough to have an editorial culture. Did you invite the editor-in-chief of Facebook on the Takeaway this morning?
No, we did not, although we took their statement.
Because they don't have an editor-in-chief.
Right, exactly.
There is no such person. And this is it's like they're at a stage of development as a company where they have an editorial role, but they don't have an editorial culture. And it's very hard for them to answer questions about editorial responsibility because it's run by engineers, and engineers want the data or the algorithm or the system to drive decision making. And sometimes what happens is that they become a little bit infatuated with themselves and they think their algorithm has more power than it does, or they think the role of human judgment is smaller than it actually is.
Or they could think that they're the smartest people in the room and the stories that they pick are the ones that are true, and the stories that they hate, they're not going to put on trending topics on Facebook. I mean, we don't know what the motives are. Sean Davis, what do you think the harm is if it's actually true that there was a systematic effort to distinguish between conservative content and so-called liberal content and exclude conservative content on Facebook? What's the harm to that? Can't people who are conservative get their information from other sources?
Absolutely can. That's what's great about the internet, is that there are no, very important, powerful gatekeepers who can prevent everyone from hearing news they don't want to hear. It is important for Facebook, and it will harm them, because Facebook is already facing a lot of turmoil and is really struggling within the publishing community as people start to see that, you know what, I've invested a lot of money in Facebook. I've run a lot of ads. I've gotten a lot of likes. Facebook doesn't let me really have access to my own audience. I don't know if it's a great business decision for me as a publisher to be pouring cash into Facebook when I could be using it to create content. So when you combine that concern that's already there, regardless of political affiliation, with one that, you know what, they're already discriminating against me and what I believe in and people like me believe in, why would I want to be involved with that company? Why would I want to give them money and buy ads with them? So I think this is a very serious problem for Facebook that goes far beyond kind of typical media questions about bias.
Do you think Facebook is biased, Sean?
Oh, absolutely.
Jay Rosen, do you think Facebook is biased?
Biased towards engineers.
Jay Rosen is the author of Press Thank, a blog about journalism in the digital age, and a professor at New York University. Sean Davis is the co-founder of The Federalist, a conservative online magazine. Sean and Jay, thank you so much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Fossil Creek has been getting its 15 minutes of fame and then some. The hiking area about 20 miles east of Camp Verde has seen its popularity rise dramatically, and that's causing some problems for it as well as nearby sites. To sort it out, I'm joined by Tom Tracy. He's a reporter for the Verde Valley newspapers and has written about this. And Tom, why are so many people visiting Fossil Creek now?
It's become very popular because a few years back, in an electronic dam as a generator was decommissioned, and to return that creek back to its original state, which was a free-flowing river. And in doing so, it made it one of the two wild and scenic rivers left in the state of Arizona.
And so as a result, people have really started going there, and that's great, except for the reasons that it's not great, which is that it's getting a lot of use and people are leaving a lot of their trash there, right?
Exactly. At the same time that this was brought back into its original free-flowing state, at the same time, social media burst out. Now, this was, of course, a well-known area for locals, but now it was becoming a well-known area nationwide and even globally. Towards last summer, the reported attendance was in excess of 100,000 people that visited that site, leaving behind tons, literally tons of trash.
So is that potentially damaging or endangering this area?
Yes. In fact, the Forest Service, Francesca Adrian, she's the Wilderness Trails and Rivers Coordinator for Coconino National Forest Red Rock Ranger District. she worked there every day, she would see things like people breaking limbs off mesquite trees to create fires, leaving behind glass containers. There's no trash facilities there per se, so people were just leaving this behind. And you can imagine what the impact was in an area when you're bringing trash in and not bringing it back out.
So it sounds like to try to mitigate that, the Forest Service has started a permitting system where they're allowing a certain number of people in there at any given time. And it sounds like that has sort of started the old balloon problem where if you squeeze one area and reduce the number of people who go to one area, all those people are still coming. They're just going somewhere else.
Exactly. And that was what was brought to my attention as a reporter. I was leaving a council meeting, and a local business person from the local craft brewery restaurant said, look, you've got to show up tomorrow. We have people spilling in the town, not knowing where to go or what to do with this change this year. And we as merchants don't know what to tell them, so we've invited representatives from the Forest Service to kind of give us a briefing at our chamber meeting tomorrow. And hence they did. They had reps from state forests as well as national parks in there to kind of talk about alternatives as well.
Well, I would imagine that in some respects, at least, businesses would be pleased that more people are coming in.
Exactly. And Camp Verde, of course, is a resort town to some degree from the folks in Phoenix heading up the I-17 north to get away from the heat. On the flip side, though, Mark, is, of course, there's also the locals. And Fossil Creek was kind of one of their coveted little secret places, so to speak. And now, of course, with the spillover, some more little quote-unquote secret places are being revealed, and some of the townsfolk are not happy.
So how do you see this all playing out?
The Forest Service has made it clear this permit system, which, by the way, just runs through the heavy usage periods, and this would not affect anything after October or before May. However, for the summer, they're going to try this year and see how it goes. They're going to limit the parking to the 148 spaces that they have. People will need to have a permit prior to showing up. That means they have to have it printed out, ready to go. So there's no facilities out there to print this out. And they're going to see if maybe they can mitigate some of the damage to this delicate ecosystem. Well aware of the facts, these folks will be spilling over into other areas. Which brings another problem in that within Camp Verde, within 20 minutes drive, are at least four or five different jurisdictions of parks. So someone may enter a park and not have the proper permit, for example, and that gets confusing.
That was Tom Tracy, a reporter for the Verde Valley newspapers. Coming up, we'll hear how a bill on Governor Ducey's desk started out as an animal rights legislation will affect Arizona's multi-million dollar gaming industry.
It was originally brought to do away with live dog racing, but the majority of the bill actually has to do with off-track betting.
The end of dog racing in Arizona, that's ahead. It's the show. In a check of international news on KJZZ, when we hear about the South China Sea, it's usually in the context of territorial disputes among China and its neighbors and the U.S. But a recent report says all the territorial haggling is hampering efforts to coordinate urgent action on overfishing. A Canadian study says overfishing in this area will contribute to a sharp rise in seafood prices around the world. The BBC's Juliana Liu has more.
I'm at a waterfront restaurant on the island of Changchow in Hong Kong. Every single table here is packed, and everyone is having seafood, which is a huge part of the eating culture. In fact, people in Hong Kong eat more than 150 pounds of seafood every year. That's about four times more than the global average. This insatiable appetite is contributing to intense overfishing. Just a few feet from the restaurant, more than 100 fishing boats of different sizes are docked.
Well, Ho Wahe has been fishing here in the South China Sea for more than 35 years, and he has seen firsthand the effects of unsustainable practices.
The number of fishing boats in the South China Sea has jumped from 70,000 to 700,000. It's 10 times more than it used to be, so it is a huge change. Mainland China's economy has taken off, and a lot of Chinese fishermen go to the South China Sea for fishing now.
How has that affected the fish?
There are more boats, so of course there's less fish stock, and each fisherman has less catch. Sustainable fishing practices are better. because there will be fishing for everyone in the future. In some countries, small fish are not allowed to be taken, and this can stop overfishing.
Much of what Mr. Ho catches ends up in outdoor wet markets with their wet, sticky floors, where a mind-boggling array of fresh seafood is sold. A study by the University of British Columbia estimates that if no action is taken, the price of shrimp will become more than 3 times more expensive in the next 3 decades. Popular fish like tuna and mackerel will be 6 times pricier, and garoupa will command 9 times the price it costs today. I asked Doug Woodring, co-founder of the Ocean Recovery Alliance, what has to be done to tackle the problem of overfishing.
So this is a very critical issue. We need the governments in the region to really work together to manage their fisheries and fish stock. There's over 3 million people a day who make their livelihoods on the fishing industry, and all of this will be gone. And without the right management, we will have social and economic impacts throughout Asia.
Governments in the South China Sea are still divided by competing claims for territory, and that may get in the way of urgent action to save the oceans.
That's the BBC's Juliana Liu in Hong Kong.
Marjorie Baldwin studied discrimination against workers with disabilities as a health economist and professor at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, until her son was diagnosed with one of the most stigmatized health conditions there is, schizophrenia. Now she studies workers with mental illness, and she's written a new book about it all called Beyond Schizophrenia, Living and Working with a Serious Mental Illness. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about this. And Lauren, what did she say are some of the more common symptoms you can recognize early when it comes to schizophrenia?
She says she saw her son start to change when he was in college. He would have outbursts of anger, he had excessive energy, and his speech stopped making sense all the time. But she says these signs can be really hard to spot, especially in our culture where we don't talk about mental illness. I asked her why it's important to recognize these early signs of mental illness and when she started seeing changes in her son.
Schizophrenia typically hits around when someone is in their late teens or early 20s. He was a junior in college. But for months before he became acutely ill, I noticed just a change in his personality. He became more irritable. He became very talkative. His behavior just became more unpredictable.
But those signs can be really hard to notice, right? Like to actually connect to a mental illness like schizophrenia.
Well, first of all, I think a parent tries to explain away things. So you don't want to believe that anything's wrong. But when you could no longer say that there wasn't something wrong, the first thought is what most parents probably would think, that he was using drugs. That's one of my big regrets, that I didn't realize that he needed more help and that I didn't do more early on.
But most parents don't know what those signs look like.
No, I don't think we're told. There's so much publicity about drugs and the dangers of drugs and the signs that your child is on drugs, but nothing about mental illness.
You talked a lot about the challenges of the mental health system and some of the ways that it lets people down, especially those with serious mental illness. Can you tell us a little bit about how hard it was to deal with the mental health care system with your son?
Yes, and I really wasn't prepared for it, because at his first diagnosis, he was treated by this excellent doctor and he was in this clinical study. They had a social worker. But after he had left college and he had a relapse, it was just literally impossible for me to get him the care that he needed. We went to find him, tried to get him into hospital. You cannot get him into a hospital unless they are in imminent danger to themselves or others. So I had to leave him behind. And knowing that he was off his medication and that he was acutely ill, and I called every social services agency that I could think of. And I even called the police and I said, my son has schizophrenia. He is off his medication. He's acutely ill and I'm worried. And they said, until somebody gets hurt, we can't do anything.
So you were in a unique position to write this book because of your research and your work as a professor at ASU. Tell me a little bit about how your research played into what you ended up experiencing with your own son?
Well, I had studied discrimination against workers with disabilities, but after David got sick, it kind of riveted my attention on people with mental illness. And, you know, I realized that schizophrenia in particular and mental illness in general are just the most stigmatized health conditions, comparable to the stigma that was associated with AIDS before we had treatments for AIDS. And the stigma is persistent, and it's pervasive across cultures. It's really the only group that it's still okay to stigmatize in the media and on television and so forth.
So through this work and through writing this book about your own son and about your research, what do you hope other parents can get out of it?
I hope that it can, first of all, give people a sense of hope that, you know, I really felt at times like I had lost my son. And there is life after schizophrenia. You can get beyond this with the drugs that we have now. You can have a rewarding and a fulfilling life. But it's also a plea to legislators to do something about the mental health system that really makes it so difficult for families to get their loved ones the care they need.
That was Marjorie Baldwin, a professor and health economist at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, talking about her new book, Beyond Schizophrenia, Living and Working with a Serious Mental Illness.
She told me her son had a difficult path with schizophrenia for a long time, but after a few years, he started volunteering with the Phoenix Dream Center, then he was hired on to work there, and now he's one of the few people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia who has really managed to recover. She said he's even worked with his doctors to wean himself off of his medications.
That's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
This election season, we've heard a lot of talk about building a wall along the southern U.S. border. It's popped up many times in Donald Trump's speeches, for example. But the process of building and maintaining a structure along a borderline and what that means for the people living there gets less attention. The show's Annika Klein spoke with an activist and photographer who has been considering these structures.
Her name is Flo Rozowski, and the photos from her project Up Against the Wall have appeared in Slate, The Wall Street Journal, and the University of Arizona's Center for Middle Eastern Studies. She makes a point of immersing herself in the location she's photographing. For the past 14 years, that's meant living near border walls and fences in different countries, beginning with the construction of the West Bank Barrier in Israel.
In 2002, I visited occupied Palestine for the first time. And while I was there, I witnessed the beginning of Israel building its wall in the West Bank. It's now a structure that is close to 500 miles long, largely concrete structure that is mostly about 25 feet high with guard towers. And so I was watching this happen, and it just kind of blew my mind. It seems so absurd that in this day and age, we consider ourselves so civilized, but that is a route that we take to build a solution for something we deem a problem.
What, at that time when you started this journey, what made you want to focus your lens on the physical structure of that barrier?
Yeah, when I started doing research, it was quickly obvious that a lot of documentation, photo documentation, written documentation that exists around the issue of building structures was focused on the people who are trying to cross the structures or who are being displaced by the structures. But I found lacking documentation that focused on the structures themselves so that as we're talking about these issues, we can actually see what it is we're talking about. And I found that there was even less documentation that juxtaposed the different structures next to each other. So I set out to fill that documentation void.
And then you stayed in several other countries as well, Bahrain, Serbia, Ukraine, Germany. Can you tell me some of the similarities and differences you noticed after going to several places, photographing these structures in various locations?
The majority of places that I have photographed have been nation-state imposed borders. So like the wall between the U.S., Mexico, the structure between Spain and Europe and Morocco. And so in those places, you know, the similarities that I witnessed were who was coming up against these structures, why they were coming up against the structures, how they were coming up against the structures, and what people were willing to lose, the risks that they were willing to take.
And now you're living in Nogales.
Mm-hmm.
Is it on the Mexico side?
I'm on the U.S. side.
On the U.S. side? In the big picture here, when you're taking photographs like this and you're including the border structures in them, I wonder what you're trying to capture about these structures that might make someone look at them differently the next time they see them.
For me, it's just about capturing the structures themselves. Those of us who aren't forced to deal with the walls in the world, you know, whether they're nation-state imposed borders or invisible barriers, those of us who don't have to see it, don't have to see it. And so one of my intentions is to put these images in front of those of us who don't have to see it so that we have to. And in my hope, it disturbs people and moves them to be engaged in work towards social change.
That's the show's Anika Klein with photographer and activist Flo Rozowski. Rozowski's photos are on display at Trio Gallery in Phoenix through Saturday. Dog racing could soon come to an end in Arizona. The state is one of just six that still allows live racing, but a bill that would end it is sitting on Governor Ducey's desk. The legislation was initially proposed by an animal rights group to end what it sees as animal cruelty. But as the show's Jimmy Jenkins reports, its effects will be felt throughout Arizona's multi-million dollar gaming industry.
A ragged rabbit lure squeaks as it skips along a rusted metal railing. The sound sends eight anxious greyhounds into a frenzy before they're released from their wooden starting boxes to barrel down the dirt track at the Tucson Greyhound Park. There used to be five dog tracks like this in Arizona, but now Tucson is the last one in the state. And while thousands used to fill the stands here, only about five people are sitting outside on a cool Saturday evening watching the dogs run in circles under the stars.
It's just something to do and fun to watch them run around the track.
Phil Clay and his wife came down from Phoenix. They like watching live racing, but don't take it too seriously.
Pick a couple numbers and see what happens without any real intelligence behind it.
There's a bigger crowd inside the racetrack clubhouse, but they're not paying attention to the greyhounds or having a drink at the Dog Days bar. They're watching simulcast videos from other racetracks around the state. And for the Tucson Greyhound Park, this is where the real money comes from. The park earns hundreds of thousands of dollars a year from other racetracks that pay to simulcast their races on TV screens in Tucson. People can come to the Greyhound Park or one of their off-track betting sites to wager on horse and dog races in other parts of the state and the country. But Arizona law mandates that to offer simulcast races and off-track betting, Tucson Greyhound Park has to offer live racing as well, which is why the dogs are still running. Eight at a time, 16 races a night, 140 nights a year, in front of mostly empty bleachers. And with each lap, the dogs may be risking their limbs and their lives.
Greyhounds are the second fastest animal on earth, and they're very fragile.
Christine Dorchak is the president of Grey 2K USA, the group behind the current racing ban effort. She says the dogs are sleek and lightweight and can run as fast as 40 miles an hour. When they bump into each other at such high speeds, their bodies just can't withstand the impact.
And that's why we see broken necks, broken legs, we see paralysis, we see spinal cord injuries.
Dorchak's group claims greyhound racing is cruel and inhumane, and they cite the Tucson track as one of the worst in the country for dog injuries. Records from the track show two dogs died racing last year, while more than 120 were injured. Video taken by Grey 2K shows the dogs are kept in their muzzles while living in cramped cages on track-owned property. Michael Rossi represents Tucson Greyhound Park. He says the industry is aware of its public perception.
Horse and dog racing nationwide has been struggling over the last many years. The sport overall is and has been in decline.
Rossi says public tastes and perceptions have turned against animal racing, and competition from casino-style gaming has only hastened the decline.
It is hard for traditional forms of gaming to compete against the very fast action of video terminals, slot machines.
He says the track owners have come to accept the end of the live racing era, but want to hold on to the lucrative simulcast revenue. So a compromise was struck between the track and the animal rights group to get a bill through the state house.
It was originally brought to do away with live dog racing, but the majority of the bill, it actually has to do with off-track betting.
Chris Ackerley represents Tucson at the legislature. He says the bill they've crafted will allow the Greyhound Park to stop hosting live racing at the end of the year and still offer simulcasting at the track and their off-track sites for 2 more years. So the park keeps their main revenue source and dog racing comes to an end in Arizona.
Which is probably a pretty good idea. But if we're going to legislate them out of business, then there needs to be an exit strategy.
Ackerley says additional legislation will be needed to determine what happens after the 2-year grace period. And the track will have to figure out what to do with the more than 400 dogs that live on their property. Some will be adopted, some will be bred, and others will go on to race at the tracks in the 5 remaining states. But after the end of the year, they won't be chasing the rabbit at the Tucson Greyhound Park anymore. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, reporting from Tucson.
Billboards are popping up across the valley and the state, raising awareness about adoption of burros. The wild creatures are cute and invasive, with an estimated population of 4,800 in Arizona. That's 3,000 more than the federal government says the environment can sustain. But since burros are federally protected, there are a limited number of ways to deal with the problem, and one of those is giving them forever homes. KJZZ's Tina Sieg reports.
After nearly 30 years together, Tom Taylor and his big-eared brown and white burro have the kind of relationship where, when he calls her,
Wallapai,
she answers. Taylor adopted Wallapai back in 1989 when she was less than a year old through the Bureau of Land Management's Adopt a Burro program. You can still see photos of the pair on the program's website, Wallapai wearing a pack saddle and Taylor leading her into the wilderness.
We are literally hiking just about every day of the year.
They've even been down the Grand Canyon together. Taylor built Wallapai a large, lush enclosure behind his home in Mesa, and they have a real connection, Taylor says, the kind he's never had with a horse.
So we've kind of built up almost a pet-like relationship.
But that's not the kind of relationship most of the state's burros have with the public. Bikers are honking and yelling at a gaggle of bored-looking burros standing in the middle of the highway near Oatman in northern Arizona. Mojave County Supervisor Stephen Moss sees this kind of thing all the time. Moss says burros are causing traffic accidents in his district every year. You've probably heard about his idea of how to change it.
Basically hunt them.
Yeah, hunt them. To be fair, he wasn't being serious.
It would be a felony. I'd go to jail, and I have no intention of going to any jail over any burros.
But the proposal did what Moss wanted. It got attention all over the country. It's probably why earlier this year, Moss found himself in D.C. in a meeting with Senator John McCain, the BLM, and the Arizona Department of Game and Fish.
Everybody in that room agreed there was a problem.
Just not on how to solve it. State and federal agencies are expected to release a plan soon. Moss says for it to be effective, it has to go beyond adoption. He hopes it adds fencing and sterilization. Moss says he actually likes the animals.
When Jesus fled Nazareth, his family was on a burro. You know, it's an animal which is closely tied to the rise of our human civilization.
But in Moss's words, that shouldn't mean burros get a blank check. The BLM says it spends more than $80 million a year nationwide on the Wild Horse and Burro program. The majority of that goes into housing the animals as they wait to get adopted. The BLM's Roger Euler is pushing a young burro with all his might into the back of a trailer at a holding facility in Florence, in southern Arizona. It takes about 15 minutes to go just a few feet. But Euler promises.
They're really kind of lovable little animals once they get calmed down.
And versatile. Euler says they're tough enough to act as guard animals and sweet enough to help calm wild horses. Dennis Park is the new owner of this little guy in the back of the trailer. Park says his friends ask him the same question.
Well, they say, why are you getting a burro? And I say, because I want one. Do I have to have a reason? I just want one. People want dogs and cats. I've had all that. Well, I never had a cat. I don't like cats.
So Park is a dog person, and now a burro person, and just the kind of person the BLM is hoping to reach. Last year, the agency adopted out only 50 burros across the state. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.